Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Keith Bybee. He's a professor of law at Syracuse University and also a political science professor at the university's Maxwell School. He recently authored a book titled How Civility Works. Keith, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Grant. Thanks.
So you've written a book on public civility that was published in 2016 during this past election cycle. Was this by design or did you just get incredibly lucky with the timing?
I'd love to say it was by design and an indication of my deep insight into American public life. But in truth, I did get lucky. This election has raised for a lot of people questions about civility. If you think about civility as the respect we owe one another in public life, certainly many people would say that that concept has been tested this election season. But if you think back, the question of whether or not we can be civil is something that has been important, posed in American public life perennially.
And I want to come back to that historical sense of where this has been. But did the idea for this book now, I mean, or at least last year, I mean, how did that germinate for you? Why did you write it when you wrote it?
Well, I wrote it in anticipation that the presidential election would bring to the forefront this question of how we ought to treat one another in public life. And as I was writing it, I was paying some attention to the primaries, in particular the Republican primaries, and I was impressed by the degree to which discourse in the Republican primaries seemed to be pushing an envelope, seemed to be not only coming right up to the line of norms of appropriate behavior, but to gleefully crossing that line. So I incorporated some of that into the book, although I did try to stay true to my topic and write in more broad sense that would be engaging for readers beyond the election as well.
So you've got an interesting argument about civility, about how it works both as a strength and a weakness, and I want to get into that in a little bit. But first I wanted just to take a couple minutes to clarify what it is you're talking about when you refer to civility. So what is public civility?
I think the simplest definition of civility is that it is the baseline of respect that we owe one another in public life. And if you look at it that way, it helps you understand that sometimes when we observe what we'd call rude or uncivil behavior, we're not necessarily witnessing a threat to civility itself. I mean, you can imagine, for example, a provocateur who engages in strategic incivility. They count on some consensus about norms of appropriate respect. They violate those norms in order to generate attention, maybe attract publicity that they can redirect towards an issue, cause, or even their own person, and use that attention for their own purposes. Someone who's doing that is aggravating. Well, we can call them rude and civil, but they're not bringing in some kind of crisis of civility. In fact, they're actually counting on a consensus of civility. I think we keep our eye on this understanding of civility as a baseline of mutual respect. It helps us just in the first instance tell the difference between somebody who's strategically violating norms of respect and someone who's seeking to do something more profound, perhaps to enter in a new inaugurate a new understanding of civility altogether.
So it sounds like then there is some kind of meaningful difference for you between public civility and being civil and being nice, being polite. Could you say a little bit about that?
Sure. I try to focus on norms of public behavior, first of all, but I have a very broad understanding of what constitutes public life. So when people gather to eat, I think that's an occasion for civility. So I would include table manners within what I mean by civility.
There was a lot of discussion about Thanksgiving this particular year because of the election and how that was going to go, I think.
Absolutely. You know, I think sometimes people think table manners in a basic sense are just a matter of hygiene, making, you know, splashing food on the people that you're dining with. But table manners, like any forum, public behavior, are opportunities for interaction. And in these opportunities for interaction, I think we're often have a chance to convey something about our own character and integrity. And civility is this not only, as I said, this baseline of mutual respect, but it's a means of communication. It's the way that I convey to you that I'm a good and decent person, that I'm going to treat you according to some mutual understanding and respect, and also to signal to you that you ought to treat me the same way. And that's as true in the House of Representatives when members of Congress are debating as it is around the Thanksgiving table when relatives gather. These are both public situations, and civility has a place in both contexts.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Keith Bybee, a Syracuse University law professor and the author of How Civility Works. Well, I think you intimated this before when you were talking about the strategic violations of our norms of civility, but you do make this argument about this paradox of public civility, that its strength is also its weakness. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure. I actually follow that paradoxical line throughout the book. And I should say for those who are listening, I wrote this book intentionally to speak to a broad audience. So even though I am an academic, it's not written in an academic fashion.
So they should buy it.
It's also a short grant, yes. So they should buy it and read it and buy many copies, give it to their friends. One of the dynamics that I'm interested in is seeing the very things that we say about civility that are indicative of its weaknesses, it's why it's ineffective, why it doesn't appeal to people, also point to the reasons that make it powerful and appealing. So I identify a number of examples of this throughout the book. Let me just give you one. It's often said, people I think who are listening will probably nod their head in agreement when they hear this, that common courtesy is not common anymore. That we live in a society where there is no civility. And many books that are written about civility are calls for a return to civility, almost an understanding maybe of a golden age where we had widespread agreement on what constituted respectful behavior and everybody adhered to it. One of the things I do in the book is look back at civility historically, and when you do that, you realize that every generation of Americans have complained about escalating incivility, and they've had no trouble at all identifying causes in their own time. So we can see in the 20th century that jazz music, World War I, the Depression, World War II, rock and roll, the Vietnam War, the large-scale entry of women into the workforce, all of these things were blamed as causes of incivility. In the 19th century, it was the vulgar rich and the insolent poor, new immigrants, the rise of cities, the Civil War. At the time of the founding, the Federalists and Anti-Federalists were embroiled in a debate over appropriate public behavior. So if you look at our history, you'll see that we've always had debates over what constitutes respectful behavior. So the question is civility even possible? There's not some golden age that we can return to. And the way that I understand that situation is that we have a profusion of different ideas about civil behavior. So the absence of civility that we experience, which we think means that nobody cares about good manners anymore, in truth is produced what we see is an excess of civilities. We have a profusion of civilities. It's the lack of agreement on a common standard, the lack of agreement on a common interpretation of a shared standard that produces this feeling that we don't have civility. So we experience civility's absence in the contents of in the context of its excess. So that's one of the just one of several paradoxical relationships that I think we have to apprehend if we have a hope of understanding the role that civility plays in our public life.
So you mentioned this constant recurring sense of civility is on the ropes, and you know we've lost our way, and this gets repeated over and over again. Did you get a sense in doing your analysis and reflecting on this that if you could put the present day on some kind of, at least for you anyway, what is a meaningful historical public civility meter, where would we be? Where would the meter be? I mean, do you think we currently are in some sort of problematic place?
Well, I tend to think, and many of the people I talk to tend to believe, that we're living in a time of unusual incivility. Mm-hmm. It certainly feels that way. Having said that, I think sometimes that historical knowledge is the rarest sort of knowledge of all. Sometimes it's difficult to get some perspective on our situation. It might be useful to compare our current situation, say, to a battle over civility in the middle of the 20th century. The civil rights movement that we often think of as achieving very important legislative goals, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But core to the civil rights movement was a struggle over the meaning of civility. There's a racial etiquette that surrounded and sustained Jim Crow segregation. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote about this in a letter from a Birmingham jail. And the battle over what constituted appropriate behavior between whites and African Americans was intensely debated. You look at the reaction to the sit-ins that took place in diners throughout the South, and how that really provoked people beyond all measure. And so when I look over the struggle in the middle of the 20th century over how we should incorporate some sense of racial egalitarianism into our ideas of civility, it's hard for me to say that now, with our debate over political correctness and what that means for civility, that we're experiencing a uniquely incivil time. Mm. So I try to remind myself that disputes over civility are, as you say, a recurring feature, and that civility is not a force that's outside of our disputes that simply just pacifies and restrains us. What civility is determined oftentimes through political conflict. And I think that's what we're going through now. We've been through it before. It feels awfully uncomfortable, unpleasant, enraging sometimes, but it's not new.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Syracuse University Law and Political Science Professor Keith Bybee about his new book on public civility titled How Civility Works. When we were talking before the break, Keith, you seemed to intimate to me that we may be in a period where the contestations about civility are going to lead us into a new understanding of what civility is or could be changing it. Is that something that you're seeing in this present day concern about civility?
I think there is some evidence of it. As I mentioned also early in our discussion, it's sometimes a mistake just to trace any violation of one's understanding of civility as a shift in a baseline. It can be that people often do tactically confront, violate norms of civility in order to advance their own purposes. That kind of person is not interested in reconfiguring what counts as civility. They're simply interested in a more local, near-term goal. But when you witness—
And counting on civility, I guess.
Counting on civility.
To make that effective.
That's right. If there weren't some kind of agreement that was somewhat broadly shared over what constituted respectful behavior, then the provocative behavior would fail to provoke. Hmm. And we see sometimes that people move beyond simply strategic incivility in order to change the way that public behavior proceeds. Historically, we saw this, say, in the 1980s when AIDS activists were seeking to change the debate around the disease and also to introduce into public discussion talk about sex, talk about minority sexual orientations, kinds of topics that were often marginalized in conventional discourse that were forbidden, really, by public decorum. So activist groups staged protests where they took over city council meetings. This was not because they hoped to proceed henceforth on the basis of protesting. It's not as if AIDS activists didn't want government to proceed and develop policy in ordinary fashion. They just wanted the discussion to change. They wanted to recalibrate what constituted respect. And I think we see some of that today in the sustained criticism of political correctness. One way of thinking about political correctness, or at least of tying it to my understanding of civility, is that political correctness is a certain understanding of the respect that we owe one another in public life. In particular, political correctness insists that we give the same measure of respect to a wide array of groups, and that we do so as a matter of presumption, that we don't wait to see if a member of a particular group is deserving of respect. We presume that they are, and in fact that we insist that others also share the same presumption of respect, again, for a very wide array of groups. One of the things I've been keeping an eye on during the past presidential election, and it's continuing now after the election took place, is the degree to which people are seeking to recalibrate this understanding of respect. President Donald Trump has done this in a spectacular public fashion, and so he's probably the easiest person to see trying to to change the baseline.
Well, I want to come back to him in a minute, but let me follow up on this idea of political correctness, because that is a hot potato topic, not only in the academy but more generally. So there is this critique of this idea of political correctness, that it's a, you know, it's a way to silence and a way to limit discussion and a way to force certain kinds of statements from folks even if they don't believe those things. And so could you say a little bit about the criticism of political correctness as well?
Sure. And I think that that criticism of political correctness as a form of silencing dissent is a criticism that actually has been applied to virtually every form of civility. So again, I'm encouraging people to think of political correctness as a form of civility, as a version. And there have been many different versions of civility, and we continue to have disputes over which version ought to prevail. But if you look back, for example, to the writings of John Stuart Mill and his classic essay on liberty, he was a great critic of manners and civility, because he thought that some understanding of appropriate behavior or decorum could easily be used to marginalize dissenters and insulate those who hold power from serious challenge and question. Because what you end up doing is that when you ask a question, you simply deem it to be out of bounds. That's rude. I don't have to respond to that. I can simply shut you down as somebody who's not conforming to baseline understanding of mutual respect. So civility has often been criticized, and in many instances rightly so, for silencing dissent. I think what's interesting, and this brings us back to one of these paradoxical ways in which civility operates, is that the very critics of civility who point to its status quo hierarchy maintaining dynamics themselves rely on civility. John Stuart Mill himself in On Liberty, after excoriating the idea of temperate speech and decorum, comes back and says, well, we ought to have an understanding of decorum. He just wanted a different understanding, one that was more inclusive of dissent. And we can understand why. Again, I mentioned a little bit earlier, one of the functions civility has is that it's a mechanism by which we communicate to one another about our integrity, our decency. You know, public life and free speech can be a place where we persuade others. It can be a place where we make connections, but it can also be a place where we make people angry. And making people angry or failing to persuade them is one thing. But having them disagree with you on the basis that you're somehow morally deficient is another. Mm. And a shared understanding of civility allows us to communicate to one another a shared sense of decency, even if we happen to disagree about the subject at hand.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse University Law and Political Science Professor Keith Bybee. So, lurking in the background of this conversation is Donald Trump, obviously. You brought him up a few minutes ago. I did have a question about him and a question about Hillary Clinton as well. So briefly on Donald Trump, if you could. You know, I think we can stipulate that at many points in this election season, he looked to have been someone that was engaging in this kind of strategic departure from civility. I mean, that seemed to be what he was up to there. It didn't seem to hurt him politically. So why was he – how was he able to be successful in that way? Why didn't he take more of a political hit for some of the things that he said?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. A good portion of what candidate Trump did was engage in strategic incivility. And before he ran for office, he, of course, is a notorious showman and self-promoter, and he knows how to attract attention. He's certainly shown us again and again that he can dominate the news cycle. And part of how he has done that is by being a provocateur, by violating some shared understanding of what constitutes appropriate behavior and then redirecting the outrage in a way that burnishes his own celebrity or advances his own purposes. I think what is interesting about candidate Trump first occurred to me, at least, in listening to what a lot of his supporters said, which is they liked that he would say things that other people wouldn't, and they liked that he would tell it like it is.
Right.
And what was he saying that people found bracing and refreshing? I think what he was saying, and we saw this even in his very first announcement of his candidacy when he, as his running mate, Vice President-elect Mike Pence has said when he whipped out that Mexican thing and made reference to Mexican immigrants, suggesting many of them were rapists and criminals of one sort or another. Candidate Trump never really backed off that. He seemed to be saying, and I think this is where it ties in with civility, that there are good Mexican immigrants and there are bad ones too. But we shouldn't presume that all of them, from Trump's perspective, deserve the same measure of respect. That we need to engage in a kind of resorting. We need to identify those who are worthy and give them the respect that they deserve. And we need to criticize and castigate those who are not. He said something similar with regard to Muslims. He suggested something similar with regard to women. That they're not all on the same plane when it comes to respect that they deserve. And so seeking, as I suggest, a kind of recalibration suggested to me even when the campaign was going on, regardless of the outcome of the November election, that we were in for a longer term set of disagreements about how we ought to treat one another. And as it turns out, Trump won. And we're having that conversation. But I really believe it would have happened even if Clinton had prevailed.
Hmm. And we just have a couple minutes left, but I wanted to look at the other side of the election through this lens of civility. Even though there were Clinton supporters who took to wearing nasty woman buttons after the debates, her ventures into a more sharper-edged kind of attack didn't seem to go over as well. And I'm wondering whether strategic incivility more general, is harder to pull off as a woman? Is there a double standard in this regard about our expectations in this way?
That's a good question. And it's one I haven't thought fully about. So in classic professorial fashion, let me answer a different question.
Oh, great.
but it's a related one, which is that I think one of the standard criticisms of candidate Clinton, of Hillary Clinton generally, is her inauthenticity. No one knows who she is. It's a sense that she's just taking a stand because the polls have told her that that will be popular, or that she's carefully honed a position. It's not what she really thinks, it's what she's just saying for current purposes. And I think inauthenticity is something that is also a criticism to level against civility all the time. I mentioned several times that civility can be useful as a means of communicating some message about our integrity. The problem with civility as a communication strategy is that it can send a false signal. This is something that came up as early as Erasmus's 15th century blockbuster on manners for children. He was immediately criticized for teaching people how to fake it. And I think that was one of the problems Hillary Clinton had, is that she was tagged as somebody who was engaged in a kind of performance of decency and not really meaning it.
That was Keith Bybee. And again, his book is titled How Civility Works. Keith, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.